Well, it's nice to have an expanded class here this morning. And as we go over the fourth week, the fourth chapter of Knowing God, and I'm going to begin by reading from Exodus 20, because Packer is really dealing here with the second commandment and does it in a very penetrating and interesting way. And so here's the second commandment. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those that hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. And so there we have the second commandment. And so the purpose here of this chapter is to understand the meaning of idolatry. And how does idolatry, what is idolatry, first of all? And then how does that affect our knowing God? How does it affect our knowledge of the Lord? And so on page 44, you'll see that Packer unpacks, as it were, this question, what is idolatry? What does the second commandment refer to, and how does it refer to Christians? And I think there are two aspects to this that are very important. Anyone want to try to take a shot at that question? So what's the principle involved in the second commandment, and how does it relate to us as Christians? I know you know. So he quotes from Hodge, and I think Hodge does, that's Charles Hodge, remember the 19th century Princeton theologian, actually whose three-volume systematic theology we used in seminary, so it's still a very good systematic theology. And he said this, idolatry consists not only of the worship of false gods, but also in the worship of the true God by images. So in other words, it's worshiping God, the true and living God, but by means that we have invented, that human beings have invented. And so remember, if you've been following the evening service in which we've been going over the Ten Commandments, what does the first commandment deal with as opposed to the second commandment? What's the distinction there? It sounds almost like it's the same. Worship no other gods. I will have no other gods before me, and then don't make carved images. What's the difference there? No other gods and no carved images. What's the fundamental principial difference there? No other gods. We're talking about what? The object of worship. The only object of worship is to be the living and true God, not the Egyptian god Re, which is the god of the sun god, or some other god, but the true and living God, the one who created the heavens and the earth and who has revealed himself to his covenant people as Yahweh, that unique covenantal name, which is I am who I am. So he is asserting ultimacy there. I remember Francis Schaeffer in his apologetics would always say that there is nothing back of God. He always had a popular way of putting profound theological truths. There's nothing behind God. In other words, the gods, with a small g, are all finite. They're limited. There's something behind them, and of course, in large part, invented by human beings. Also, the Bible refers to gods with a small g as those who are in positions of rule and power, so they are real. But the gods that are being forbidden here are replacements for the true and living God. So that's the object of worship. I'm the only one in all the universe that's to be worshipped. That's commandment number one. Commandment number two, then, how does it differ from that? No carved images. Ginny? The manner, exactly. That's the word, the manner in which. How do we worship him? Okay, if he's the true object of our worship, then how is it that we worship? And he's putting it in the negative, saying, don't worship me through your own imaginations, through images, through things that you carve and make in order to sort of get to me. That's not the way that I want you to worship me. I always like to use, whenever I teach this in our public profession class, the illustration of One year, I can remember writing letters to Robin, love letters, of course, before we were married, and I can remember writing them, and then she would write back, and they were revelations of ourselves and our feelings towards one another. Now, I would never, despite the fact that I think this was done in the chivalric tradition of the Middle Ages and into the Reformation, have someone else write a love letter to her for me. Why? Because I want to reveal myself the way I actually am to her. Because as human beings, we don't always do that, honestly. But that's what we're doing. I don't want anyone else to represent me to another person. And that's what the Lord is saying in the second commandment. I don't want any other way of representing who I am, especially because you're sinners and you're going to distort who I am, except the way that I have given you. And what is that? Where do we understand the manner in which we are to worship God truly? Where does that come from? From the Word. It comes from the Bible. And so he teaches us in the Bible exactly how he wants us to worship him. And of course, the Bible itself is, notice I said this in my prayer before Sunday school, it is God's self-revelation. It's what he wants us to know about him. And because he is the living and true God, the picture he gives in the Bible is an accurate one. It's one that we can truly depend upon. And so I love that in Exodus 3:14, where he reveals himself to Moses. Moses is afraid to go to Israel, the people of God, in Egypt, and tell them that he's going to lead them out. He's afraid. And so he says, "Who should I say sent me? You know, what's the authority?" And God gives this wonderful statement. "I am who I am." Say that. "I am who I am sent me." I can still remember at Bible school, there was a fellow student and I who liked to explore theology. And one day we were having a conversation about what an amazing statement this is. Anyone who thinks they can figure out God hasn't read this or much of the Bible. I am who I am. You can't figure me out because I am the ultimate one. I am sui generis, unique. There's no one else like me. And so how can anyone decide that they're going to figure out a way to worship him on their own? And so he gives two different aspects of the dangers of making false images of God or using images to worship God, using our own inventions to worship God. And the first is it dishonors God. How do images dishonor God? How do they dishonor God? Yeah, Carl?
There's no likeness.
Right. There's no likeness in the created order that is sufficient to reveal who he is. There's nothing in the created order. Because God is what? He's a spirit. He's invisible. He's infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. He cannot be seen with the eye. Now, it is true that the creation, in every part of the creation, from the tiniest cell to the most magnificent display of the Milky Way, is a revelation of God, of some aspect of his nature. But no single thing is adequate, no single image or idea is adequate to say who he is in the created order. So it limits him in a way that really, it eclipses his glory. I think he quotes Calvin here somewhere as saying that it is, at the bottom of page 45, what Calvin says is, "A true image of God is not to be found in all the world, and hence his glory is defiled and his truth corrupted by the lie whenever he is set before our eyes in a visible form. Therefore, to devise any image of God is itself impious, because by this corruption his majesty is adulterated, and he is figured to be other than he is." Now, this is God triune in his majesty. But think about this. Think about the ways in which the crucifix, for example, what would that eclipse? There are people who would say, you know, this helps people in their devotion. And no doubt it may. But what does it do? How does it dishonor what God did in Christ to just have Christ on the cross suffering. Daniel?
It eclipses resurrection.
Right, exactly. It eclipses his resurrection. And so you can see how images, they bring the focus down to earth, as it were, and they're never big enough to encompass the whole of what God is and what he's done for us in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so he quotes from Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 18, "To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness compare with him?" That's a beautiful statement that really just puts the cap on the point that Packer is making here. And then the second one, yes, Landon. Yeah, no, you're right. That's something that if we moved on to that next point, we would have missed. And there, the idea that it's so important, and I remember learning this back in preaching class, in homiletics class in seminary, and one of the points made by the professor is, what you don't say is as important as what you do say. And it's good that we don't say things that are our own opinions, but if we don't say the whole of what's going on in the Word, you know, in the process of expositing the Word in your ministry, what you don't say can do a great deal of damage. So, for example, we could preach on God's love all the time and never preach about sin. We could preach about the glories of heaven and never preach about hell. And this would be distorting. So it would be true. What we say about love is true, although you can't really talk about God's love without talking about sin. But it would be true in as much as you were biblical, but it would be missing a huge point. And so in that sense, it would end up being false. So what is not revealed in images is a huge problem. And one of those examples, of course, was the crucifixion. It really eclipses the resurrection and the exaltation and a whole bunch of other things. Okay, so we go to the second point then, which is that it also misleads. It conveys false ideas about God. So it's not only that it may say a true thing, but eclipse the other important things. But now it actually produces false ideas. This begins at the very bottom of page 46 and goes over to page 47. And I was thinking about The Passion. Remember The Passion? Mel Gibson's? That was all the rage. There was just tons of critiques of it and promotion of it and a great debate within evangelicalism. And it was very interesting to watch. I was giving a series of lectures at a little college in Lynchburg, Virginia. What year did The Passion come out? I can't really remember. It was in the early part of this century. And I can remember using this as an example of the danger of visual images, really making this same point. And there was a woman, a very mature Christian, in the audience. And she took strong exception. I mean, I had stepped on a sacred cow and I critiqued Mel Gibson, who, by the way, is a Roman Catholic. So Protestants should be a little suspicious right there. But she did not want to hear. She said, this has done so much evangelistic good. And I still get all kinds of promo material in the mail for the Jesus film. There are a bunch of different ones. But what would be the problem with that? People, evangelicals who are Bible believers and believe the gospel, believe that this is a real evangelistic tool. Daniel? Exactly. What is a movie? It's simply a series of moving images. And in fact, moving in one sense, but also moving in another. Their film is powerful. It grips you. Those images in a good movie, a movie that's well done. I never saw The Passion on principle, but I understand that it was very powerful. I talked to a friend recently who said that, you know, it had him in tears because it focuses on one aspect of Christ's suffering, and that is especially the physical. Now, whatever he may have said on the cross could have revealed more than that, but what are some of the other problems with that? What did Jesus look like? What did he look like? Mel Gibson? We don't know. We don't know what Jesus looked like. And I think that, of course, is a very significant thing. What did Jesus look like? The second thing is, we don't have the interpretation of the event. You see the event, but the interpretation of the event is what is there in the New Testament. So you remember that in the Bible, you have essentially three aspects to God's self-revelation. He tells us what he is going to do, he does it, and then he explains the significance of it. And of course, the two great events in the Bible, the two great redemptive events are what? Two great redemptive events. The Exodus and the resurrection. So there you have those two great events, and you see the whole of the Old Testament, of course, is predicting the coming of Messiah, his life and death and resurrection, a new creation. It's all predicting that. And then God actually does it. He comes into history, and then the whole of the New Testament explains the significance. So when you read the Gospels and you read the suffering, it's being explained to you. It's being interpreted. And that cannot happen in a movie, at least not in the complete and full and rich and deep way that it happens in the New Testament. But think of another reason. What's another reason? Why does the Bible not explain or describe to us in detail what Jesus looked like? Yes, Ginny? Yes, I always liked the Hallman picture. He looked like a hippie with long blonde hair. But yes, that's exactly right, is that because we're all so different, and not just different ethnically, but we're different in the way that we look. And of course, you know, in this room, we're a tremendous mix. I mean, I'm a mongrel of five different nationalities that I know of. And with the Vikings, you never know what else is mixed in there. And so imagine, it's one of the reasons that we don't have an American flag there along with the so-called Christian flag. I forget where that came from. But if someone from another nation comes and worships with us, what does that say? That we're American Christians? Is that the first thing? No. We're Christians. And we just happen to live in this wonderful country called the United States of America. We are diverse. And I remember once when we were in New Rochelle, I forget how I even came in touch with this. I was probably looking through the art section in the library, and I found this book on images of Jesus throughout history. And it's amazing the number. You have black Jesus, you have Oriental Asian Jesus, you have American Jesus, you have Jewish Jesus, and even within that you have 20 different renditions of what a Jewish Jesus would look like. And so because the gospel goes to the nations, the Lord wanted us to identify with him, not only in terms of his humanity, as it were, in general, but his exalted humanity. Remember, he doesn't want his disciples to get excited about seeing him in the flesh in history, because he is going to go away so that he can administer the affairs of his church from his throne in heaven and spread the gospel, not just to one little tiny geographical location, but throughout the civilized world. And so it's so important. And one of the things that you have to do whenever you have a movie is you got to pick an actor to do Jesus. So I'm surprised that we don't have, at some point, a transgendered version or something like that. I mean, the danger of the images, especially in a movie, I think is huge. Carl? Yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent point, Carl, that the writers would have been believers, and they would have been worshiping Jesus, the man, as God in the flesh. And so they would have been very aware of the implications of the second commandment in their writing under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. Ron? Yes, just summarizing that in the Shekinah was what we saw, which was the blazing glory of God, his majesty, and it really defies description. And when we get to the New Testament, Jesus revealed who God was in the flesh as a man, as the God-man, and yet there are no statues or any of those things that are present in history of him, which is remarkable. It's also probably one of the reasons why Calvin and some others didn't want their graves to be known. They were buried anonymously so that they wouldn't be idolized, as it were. And so Jesus is the full revelation of God, and only at his second coming will we see him as he is. And that's hard, really, to imagine what that will be like in terms of space and time. Daniel? Oh, yes. So Paul, there on Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17, is clearly in confronting the unbelief of the Athenians, especially the philosophers. He is challenging their idolatry, their tendency as fallen human beings to make gods with a small g after their own artifice, after their own artistic sculptural abilities. Now, when it comes to Sunday school materials, if you notice in Great Commission publications, and I found our policy, it's actually five pages. Back in 1981, the OPC, in partnership with the PCA, had to grapple with this question, and it's called the use of pictorial representation of Christ in the work of Christian education. The policy adopted by the trustees of Great Commission Publications on March 6th in 1981. And it had originally been adopted by our Christian Education Committee. It was adopted by us, and then we brought it to the board as trustees of GCP. I'm not going to read all of this, but if anyone's interested, I could send the whole document to you. And it's just very clear that we need to be careful using images of Jesus in Sunday school material. So you won't see it. But what's interesting is, how many of you are familiar with Tom Tyson's little sketches in the Shorter Catechism commentary of G.I. Williamson? He did these little stick figures, and that's totally different. But why is that different? Why would stick figures be acceptable? A stick figure of Jesus, you know, if there's the Sermon on the Mount, he drew a little line, and there was someone at the top of the mountain, and then a bunch of other people, all little stick figures. How would that work? Is that legitimate? Well, I think you probably know what my opinion on this is, that it is legitimate. Now, it's also interesting, and we'll get to this actually at the very last subject that I want to cover here, if we have time, which is art. Rembrandt, several years ago, Robin came to Christian Ed with me, and after the meetings were over on Wednesday, we made the trek down to the Museum of Art in Philadelphia. By the way, a magnificent place to go. From a distance, when you get off the subway, you can see the art museum, and there's this magnificent neoclassical building with huge, I think, Doric pillars. And there was an exhibit of the most of the etchings of Rembrandt that I've ever seen in one place. It was a remarkable exhibit. And what was so interesting to me, that unlike El Greco, and I saw years ago when I lived in Spain briefly, I went to the Prado in Madrid and saw El Greco. And these are also amazing pictures, but they definitely depict Jesus so that you remember what his face looks like, his physical features. He didn't look very Jewish, as I remember it, probably more European. Anyway, and that's to be expected. But I can just remember looking at the Rembrandt, who himself, I think, was a serious Christian, that you don't bring away a distinct image of Jesus. What you get from those sketches, and I wouldn't want us to use them as a means of worship, but I think they're in a different category than some of the medieval pictures and then Greco in a different era of Jesus, because you look at them and you picture the scene, and oftentimes he was a master of light, and you see, you know, light pouring into the scene, and you remember what's going on in the gospel. And for me anyway, though I wouldn't ever recommend having them in the church, there was a difference between those two things. And I think it's a subtle difference, to be sure. But I think, as Packer makes a point, what's in an art museum is in a different location and for a different purpose than using it for worship. Now, could we make the mistake of using those images for worship? Absolutely. And that's something that we would have to be very careful of. But when it comes to Sunday school material, and I would say this of, you know, there are illustrated Bibles that, you know, story Bibles for young children that have pictures of Jesus, that there is that temptation there. And I was happy that GCP came out with that clear statement. And it's very nuanced. I mean, they really, it's a very carefully, theologically worked out statement. This is just the conclusion, the summary of sort of how do we apply this to the actual production of Sunday school material. Comments on that? Daniel. The question is the second commandment aimed at the manner of worship only, or would it have anything to do with the way that we might want to conceive of God in terms of images? And that's really the gist of this question. It's a subtle one. I think that, yes, primarily it's dealing with worship, but worship can be both corporate and it can be private. So could we make an image and then worship it? Actually, in the book of Judges, we have something similar to that with making an image and worshiping it sort of in a private chapel of an individual there. And so I think, you know, there's a subtle difference, but idolatry can happen anywhere with any image. And so I think that we just have to be careful with that. But I do think that certain artwork may be acceptable without crossing that line. But then, of course, it also has, I mean, when I saw El Greco, I just was able to appreciate his paintings of Jesus, and they were, I think, all of the Passion in this one room that was just surrounded by them. And these were paintings that were 8 feet wide and 12 feet tall. They were just huge. And I could appreciate his artistry. I wasn't in any way tempted to worship through that, and I wasn't in any way tempted to think that this is what Jesus actually looked like. But in the medieval church, pictures of Jesus and the saints were meant specifically to be means of worship for people who couldn't read. And that's why in the Reformation, one of the great impetuses of the church was to get people to read, to teach them to read so that they would be word rather than image oriented. So, but that's a good question, or a good comment. Tom, and then Ginny. Oh, that's interesting. So the iconic tradition in the Eastern Church, both Russian and Greek, would have some sensitivity to this question in that their images are flat. It's funny that you say that, because I was always thinking it was sort of before they got perspective down. You can see this in a lot of the Latin paintings and things. But that's interesting that that was explained to you, that they were being sensitive to the second commandment. Did they come out in the right place? I don't think so. But at the same time, it's interesting to see, you know, I always used to critique the Amish for their deciding to stop technological development at a certain point. And then also, it's kind of humorous part of the critique to say that though they didn't like Chrome because it was worldly, that I actually saw with my own eyes a very beautiful black-on-black Porsche parked in an Amish driveway out in Lancaster County. And I thought, I think there's a little funny inconsistency here. But in critiquing them, I then discovered that when the telephone was invented, they didn't just reject the telephone, but that they made sure that it was in a public place so they could use it for what it was most useful for, communicating within the community, but it didn't have the danger of separating, dividing, and undermining, especially the family. So I thought, while I wouldn't necessarily come out in the same place, similar to what you just said, Tom, it's interesting that they were thinking about the important media ecology questions, and so there is some thinking about the second commandment, which any reader of the Bible, of course, is going to be confronted with. Ginny. That's right. What's the reference in that? So in 2 Corinthians 5:16, then Paul says that we don't any longer know him according to the flesh. Why? Because he's ascended in glory. That's a very important point, and thank you for that. Now, as we move on, Packer says, if you turn to page 47 now at the bottom, Packer says, psychologically, it is certain that if you habitually focus your thoughts on an image or picture of the one to whom you are going to pray, you will come to think of him and pray to him as the image represents him. And so the question is, have you been trained or encouraged to focus on some image of God? What steps can you take to free your mind from images? I read someone just recently in preparation for this who had been to see Gibson's Passion, and they said, to this day, when they pray, they cannot get from their mind the image that is left there. So we record everything that we see. We don't always remember it, but it had a powerful impression on him. So how would you imagine overcoming that? He didn't tell how he overcame it, the person that I read. So that's a question. What would be ways of overcoming this, to free the mind from such images? I'm sure that people in the Reformation who were learning to read and had become Christians through the preaching of the gospel had to wrestle with that. Daniel? And so being renewed by the Word of God, not only private reading and devotion, but also through the hearing of the preaching, the atmosphere of the Word then is the only real antidote to the poison of distorting God through images. Then another question would be, why is a false mental image as harmful to knowing God as a physical representation? So this is so interesting, because we usually are thinking images, we think of what? We think of things that we see. But Packer's challenging us to think a little bit deeper about this and think about images, the imagination, which of course is a gift of God. So the question then is, why is that as harmful to knowing God as a physical representation? And what he goes on to say is simply this, that this kind of idolatry is formed then in the fallen imagination. Now, I would think that the two relate very much to one another. As I just said with the passion, this person now has in their imagination this picture of Gibson's passion. I forget who it was that played Jesus in that. So he has that image that's sort of stuck in his mind. So imagination and what you see with your eyes and what's there in your imagination, that's what our dream lives are at least in large part made up of. And so the fact is, it's just like the physical representation. It just doesn't tell us everything we need to know about God, and it actually distorts it. Plus, it doesn't say the things that should be said about God. It doesn't teach us that, which, again, only the Word can really correct. Now, what is the positive purpose of the second commandment? I like the way he now gets into this question of the positive purpose. This is over on just the upper third there of page 48. What is the positive purpose of the second commandment? Notice it's stated negatively, as are most of the commandments of the ten. What's the positive purpose? Ginny? Exactly. That was exactly the quote that I had written down here, because I think it really sums up what he's saying, is that God the Creator is transcendent, mysterious, and inscrutable, beyond the range of any imagining or philosophical guesswork of which we are capable. And what does this do in terms of our spiritual position before God? What does this do to us? When we understand that he's beyond our imagining, what effect is that supposed to have upon us in the Bible? It's supposed to humble us. I can remember coming out of Eastern mysticism, it was all about going inside of yourself and trying to imagine yourself as part of the great one. It was a kind of monism. And you got wrapped up in yourself, so you were just like always looking within for answers in a sense. And to me, one of the great liberating powers of the gospel was that it got me outside of myself, God transcendent. It was a wonderful reversal of the natural tendency to get all wrapped up in ourselves. God is glorious, and he is high above our thoughts. He also quotes from Isaiah 55, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts," God tells us, "neither are your ways my ways. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." And then Paul in Romans 11 says, "Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom of God and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord?" And of course, in a wonderfully imaginative way, this is inspired imagination, the writer of Job, if you read that book, especially at the end, Job goes to the zoo with the Lord, as it were, and he ends up realizing how he cannot trace out the ways of God, that the ways of God are beyond his imagining. In any case, that makes, I think, a very strong and telling point, all meant to humble us. And so, what point does he make about, this is very interesting, going now to Sinai, Deuteronomy chapter 4, What is it biblically there in that chapter that really emphasizes the point that he's making about images versus the written word of God? What happens there at Sinai? Do they see God? Do they see an image of God? No. They hear his word. And so it's very telling there in Deuteronomy 4. In fact, the very beginning of the chapter begins this way. It says, "And now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the rules that I am teaching you, and do them that you may live and take possession of the land that the Lord is giving you." So listen with the ear. There was no image there to be seen. There was a frightening revelation with the thundering and the lightning and the shaking of the mountain, but they didn't see an image, which is so interesting. And so everything in the tabernacle points to God being majestically invisible and approached only through the blood of the Lamb, through the sacrificial priesthood. And so Deuteronomy 4 then becomes a very powerful biblical proof of everything that he is saying about the second commandment. Now, what is it? And here, we don't talk too much about this. He makes the statement something like this, that notice, when they worship the golden calf, what happens after that? What does the golden calf worship end up as? An orgy. So what does that teach us about the relationship between idolatry and our moral, ethical lives? Bill? Okay, so that's getting at the point. So we're made in God's image. Then we have the whole idea of anthropomorphism, which is that there are man forms that are used to describe, human forms to describe God. But we as sinners make God after our image. That's not what's supposed to happen, but that's what we do as sinners. Why do we do it? This is the question of the relationship to worshiping the golden calf and the orgy. Why do we make God after our own image? Think of the Greek pantheon. The Greek pantheon is full of a lot of wickedness. What is that? It's simply an image. It's a reflection in artistic and imaginative form of sinful humanity. You have adultery, you have murder, you have theft, you have lying. It's all there in the Greek and Roman pantheons, which were the gods of those people. And so what we do is we suppress the truth and unrighteousness, and we invent images of God that will actually rationalize our sin, our sinful ways. So we go, okay, this is the way I am. This is the way I want to live as a sinner. And now I need gods to sort of reinforce my sinful ways. And that, of course, is the huge danger. And that's why in the Bible, in the Old Testament, the prophets in particular, in Psalm 115, Psalm 135, are constantly really ragging on the idolaters and making fun of them and saying, yes, they have mouths, but they can't speak. And guess what? You have to actually pick them up. The people that created these gods have to pick them up and move them. And so they're making fun of them and saying, you know, they're not God, but they're made for a reason. They're made to rationalize the sins of fallen human beings. So as we wrap up, we've just got about 2 minutes here. Let me ask you this question. What is the test of whether or not we are worshiping the true God? What's the test? It's a very important and kind of a surprise ending to this chapter. How do we know? I mean, that's the practical question that pilgrims ask. We're not watching now from a balcony. It's a question that eternity in our lives depends upon. So what's the test? Daniel? That's it. And so it's the gospel. That's the only way that we can know that we know the true and living God. Because if you know me, you know the Father, he said in the upper room. And so it's only through the gospel. Otherwise, our whole tendency is going to be idolatry. Now, as Christians, of course, we have to be very careful. Because remember the distinction that Hodge makes at the beginning. He says there's the worshiping of false gods. That's the first commandment. That's what pagans do. But idolatry in the second commandment is aimed at us and our worship, making sure that believers have pure worship. And why is it so? Because as we saw in the Old Testament with the golden calf, very quickly, the living and true God reveals himself to them, leads them out of Egypt, and they make a false god. So we are capable, the Bible is telling us, of having false gods, of letting the world around us intrude. Their means of worship can become ours. And that's why I'm constantly warning us about, and I have to warn myself about the popular culture, all the cultural artifacts around us. And it doesn't have to be popular culture, it can also be high culture. It can tend to intrude upon us in a way that distorts our image. That's why the way that we worship, the manner in which we publicly worship God, is so very important to protecting us from what some would just call, you know, style or taste. It's not a matter of taste. And when people change, and I hear constantly of churches that they suddenly change. I have some people that I know very well, they're friends, and they said, "We didn't leave our church." They did, but they didn't really leave their church. Their church left them. And it went from a good, solid expositions of the Bible, where you're expected to bring your Bible to worship, to worship light with a 10 or 15 minute sermon that really wasn't rooted in the text of Scripture very clearly, and loads of popular music. And this is what their worship turned into. And they were heartbroken, and they had to leave because they said there was no longer the true worship. They, I don't think, knew anything about media ecology or any of these things. What they understood was that the worship had been corrupted by the intrusion of things in the popular culture that we need to leave there in terms of our worship. So the question we were going to get to at the very end, and you can think about this, maybe we could have a brief discussion, is the place of art. And it's interesting. Someone asked this question that I got from a book of questions on this chapter. It says, "What implications does Packer's argument in the first part of this chapter have for Christian art? For instance, how would his view affect an artist's choice of subject?" I have a problem with the idea of Christian art. Is there such a thing? I don't think so. There are Christian artists. And Mikoto Fujimura, by the way, go to his website and you'll find what one of the people that I think is an amazing modern contemporary artist. He's not a pure abstractionist, though you might think so when you first go to the site, but read some of the things. He's also very articulate and has written some wonderful essays on his understanding of what it means for a Christian to be an artist. But that's a question. That's not an easy one. I've been wrestling with this all of my Christian life, and I think I've come to some point of understanding. But I just have a question. Is there Christian art? That's a question. Think about that, and we'll pick this up next week.